This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
For those who will be listening to this on recording because they couldn't make the lecture, I apologize. And for those who actually were able to come because they were busy last night, we're very happy you're here. And welcome to everybody. Without further ado, we'd like to invite Professor Gavni to give the second in this wonderful series. This lecture will be Second Temple Judea and the Diaspora, Equal Partners or Center Periphery. Thank you.
Last week, I tried to deny any relevancy to the present in what I discussed. I doubt I was very successful. But even if I was last week, there's no way that that will work this week. I think almost from the very first source that we're going to read, you will read into the source all sorts of understanding, I think almost allusions, either obvious or hidden, to realities that we recognize today. Let me explain what I want to discuss. There are two sides to this coin that I'm going to discuss today. For a Jew living in the diaspora, the question will be, on the one hand, is there a sense of belonging? Of belonging where one lives, something that some scholars have referred to as local patriotism, feeling at home, and stressing that we belong. Can that Jew, at the very same time, maintain more than a relationship with the land of Israel and with Jerusalem and the temple, but a commitment to the land? And this, of course, conjures up, depending on what side of the issue you come to, it conjures up this image of dual loyalties. Where do you really belong? If you're a non-Jew living in the diaspora, in the Jewish diaspora, can we really trust you? If your allegiance is elsewhere, how should we relate to you? And I believe that you can't really understand the relationship between Jews of the diaspora and what we have referred to as the center, that's the question, of course, in the land of Israel, unless you actually analyze what was being said at the time. And again, the danger is we're going to constantly read into these sources what we understand today. Let me give you an example of the very first source. Strabo was a Greek geographer, or he wrote a major work on geography from the first century BCE and into the first century of the Common Era. So he straddles, as it were, centuries just prior to the destruction of the Second Temple. And he's quoted quite liberally by Josephus, our historian. And whenever one discusses the Jewish diaspora, they almost invariably use this as their opening. Strabo has the following to say: this people, meaning the Jews, has already made its way into every city, and it is not easy to find any place in the habitable world which has not received this nation, and now comes the best phrase, and in which it has not made its power felt. Aha! And we have been conditioned, meaning all of the people in this room, when we see a line like that, we know what they really mean, right? They control the media, they control the banks, right? Their power, the media part of it, right? Right. Hollywood, right? Strabo actually was one of our friends. And in fact, Josephus got a hold of him at a later stage of his career, and he uses him very often to balance what was written about Jews by those who weren't too friendly to us. Actually, the translation here suggests something else. It doesn't really refer to power as this frightening image, But what Strabo was really saying is their presence is felt. In other words, they are everywhere, which is something that the Jewish philosopher Philo and Josephus and others are going to say as well. Jews have spread out throughout the habitable world. And so I would be very careful not to read into this something that's not here. Now, that doesn't mean we're going to avoid some very nasty stuff today. Non-Jews, seeing Jews living in the diaspora, had very definite opinions about that phenomenon. Where do I start? I thought the best place would be one of the earliest references to diaspora in the Bible. I mean, as I mentioned last week, there was no real diaspora in the biblical period. It only really appears before us with the, or just prior to the destruction of the first temple, actually the Assyrian conquest of northern Israel and then the destruction of Jerusalem. Now, you remember that just prior to the destruction of the first temple, the prophet Jeremiah, who ultimately will make his way to Egypt, nevertheless writes a letter to those Israelites that had already been transferred to Babylonia prior to the destruction. You remember there were two conquests just a few years apart. The ultimate conquest was in 586. A few years before that, there was an earlier conquest of Jerusalem, but not a destruction. And Jeremiah writes the following. This is in the fourth year of King Zedekiah, Tzidkiyahu. So it's around the year 594 BCE, more or less. And Jeremiah tells them how to behave now that they've been transported abroad. Build houses and dwell in them. Plant gardens, eat their produce, take wives and beget sons and daughters. Take wives for your sons, give daughters to husbands, that they may bear sons and daughters, that you may be increased there and not diminished. Seek the welfare of the city to which I have deported you. Pray on its behalf to God, for on its welfare your own begins. What is this? This is the first reference to Tfilah L'Shlom HaMedina, right? A prayer for the success of the nation or the country in which you live. I'm always and by the way, this is the ideological basis for that prayer, because Jeremiah actually says it, pray for them, because their success will ultimately filter down to you. There's no mention here about, and also send money to Jerusalem if you can. There's absolutely no reference here to a center, although the right temple had not been destroyed yet, but Jeremiah assumes, or may assume, that that will happen. But yes, pray for the welfare of the state that you live in. I have to tell you, this is a private reflection. That prayer, L'Shlom HaMedina, I never really appreciated until my years being sent clandestinely to the former Soviet Union. And I was sent by the State of Israel a number of times way back in the 70s and found my way into the synagogue in Moscow on Arkhipova Street. And it was really striking. People actually spoke throughout the prayer service. There was only one moment of absolute silence, and that was Tfilah L'Shlom HaMedina. That's when you were very careful to keep your mouth shut. Right? That's when I was told for the first time in the synagogue, be very careful, because half of the people in the shul worked for the KGB, and I asked them which half, and I was told either one. But the point is, if you read Jeremiah, you're really being told, settle down for the long haul. And not just settle down for the long haul, but try to immerse yourself in the environment, in the atmosphere. Right? And one way of doing that is by, of course, praying for the success of that country. But ultimately, Jews living in the diaspora had to really come to terms with this dual loyalty. Yes, we want to belong here, but we have Jerusalem, we have a temple. And they grapple with it. And one of the best places to begin, I think, is source number 3, written by the Jewish philosopher of Alexandria, Philo. He writes this at a time of major disturbances, almost leading to pogroms between Jews, or clashes between Jews and Greeks in Alexandria in his day. Flaccus was the governor in Alexandria at the time, in the first century, of some major disturbances. And Philo explains how Jews relate to the country in which they live. For so populous are the Jews, now this we read last week as well, if you remember, that no one country can hold them. And we said there's some sort of an apologetic, you know, what are we doing abroad? We're here because we are so numerous, because God was so benevolent, and he promised Abraham that your seed would multiply, and sure enough, he came through. And so no one country can hold them. Therefore, they settle in very many of the most prestigious countries. But now comes the interesting line, and that's why I drew a line underneath. And while they hold the holy city, meaning Jerusalem, where stands the sacred temple of the Most High God to be their mother city, Metropolis, right? Yet those meaning those cities which are theirs by inheritance from their fathers, grandfathers, and ancestors even farther back, meaning those cities in which they live today abroad and in which their fathers and grandfathers also resided, right? Those cities are in each case accounted by them to be their fatherland in which they were born and reared, to some having come at the time of their of those cities' foundation as immigrants to the satisfaction of the founders. Meaning, they consider this other country in which they live to be their fatherland. So what do they have? They have what the Greeks called deutera patris, a dual homeland, a dual fatherland. This is not an idea developed by Jews, but it is one that Jews could adopt. That is, we have two, I won't say types of allegiance, although that's the case as well, but we feel totally at home in this country that we live, even though we recognize that there's a holy city. Elsewhere, Philo elaborates, or rather, he doesn't even talk about Jews per se, in a text that talks about, or really praises, Augustus, the Roman emperor, who, according to Philo, did not demand setting up statues of himself around the empire, even though he deserved this because of his benevolence. Philo says something which I think in passing is very interesting. Every city that contains magnificent works, new and old, is surpassed in these by the beauty and magnitude of those appropriated to Caesar. In other words, decorations for Caesar, right, supersede anything else. And especially, and now comes this line, I wonder if Philo, I think he did it on purpose, especially in our own Alexandria. Now that's saying something. In other words, here's Philo, the Jew, certainly believes in the temple and in Jerusalem, referring to our own Alexandria. And as I said, you know, we could place him in 19th century Germany, where a Jew would say, our land, right? The difference being that I doubt if the Jew would have given the first sentences, right, his allegiance to Jerusalem in the 19th century in Germany. I don't think this would have come through the exact same way. Why does this come to the fore in the first century and in the days of Philo? A number of events took place that required Jews, at least mentally, to ask themselves, where do they really belong? Can they maintain this dual loyalty, or does it somehow become inoperable? It simply doesn't solve the problem. And you have to take a stand. And of course, lurking in the back always is my, I wish I knew, what did the Jews of Israel think at the same time? When they looked at these Jews at the diaspora, and this is one of the issues that we may begin to take up today, but I'll certainly take up next week, and that is, as Jews in the diaspora were claiming what? Our own Alexandria, and they'll do this, by the way, in Babylonia as well, right? The ultimate and original homeland of the Jewish people. What did the people in the land of Israel think about that? Were they writing nasty letters to their cousins in Alexandria saying, how can you say that about Alexandria? Or did they appreciate it? Now, you might think, well, as long as the Shkalim kept rolling in, right, and there was pilgrimage, they realized that it wasn't all that prudent maybe to come out against this, right, loyalty of Jews in the diaspora. But that's not always the case. But here again, source number four is interesting. I have to put you in the context, and then we'll read the source. The year 37 of the Common Era sees the rise to the throne in Rome of Gaius Caligula. Gaius Caligula was, I mean, you can argue that he was insane. I don't know if that's exactly the case, but as you know, beginning with Augustus, there was something called emperor worship in the Roman Empire. If the Romans liked you, appreciated what you did, you would become ultimately a god. Upon your death, Augustus, upon his death, becomes a deity. Not all the emperors, well, you know, you have to wonder, what did the emperors themselves think about it? And we have one great example where Vespasian is lying on his deathbed, and he's surrounded by his henchmen who are waiting for the ultimate right death. And he looks up at them and he says, I fear I'm about to become a god. You know, so somehow this great urge to join the pantheon, right, up that doesn't come through in that sentence, right? But of course, there was a perfect solution, which Gaius discovered. Why wait until your death? Why not proclaim your deity in your lifetime? For Gaius Caligula, that might have worked, but not for the rest of the Roman Empire. And after 4 years, they in January of 41, in fact, I think we are almost on the yard site. if I remember correctly, it's either a day in ahead of us or behind us. So if you want to celebrate this, he was assassinated by the Romans. They realized that this has gotten out of hand. Before that happened, however, one of his decrees was to set up some sort of a statue of himself in Jerusalem. He required that the Roman governor Petronius set up the statue. Petronius realized he has a problem. To set up the statue in Jerusalem would cause, of course, would raise havoc among the Jewish people. And he starts dragging his feet. You know, it's winter, let's wait till summer, etc., etc. And he, of course, got off the hook when Gaius was himself assassinated. But everybody tries to dissuade Gaius Caligula from doing this, certainly Jews. And the most prominent Jew to make an attempt at dissuading Gaius from that, right, irrational decision was Agrippa I, Herod, King Herod's grandson. Agrippa was one of the few people who had the nerve to talk to Gaius Caligula because they went to kindergarten together. Herod sent his grandchildren, right, or his grandson, to grow up in Rome, and they literally grew up as youngsters, as children together. And so Agrippa writes a long letter to Gaius, trying to convince him not to do this. And this is part of the letter. As for the holy city, I must say what befits me to say, meaning Jerusalem. While she, as I have said, is my native city. Now, this is interesting. Remember, it is his native city. She is also the mother city, not of one country, Judea, but of most of the others, in virtue of the colonies. Remember that use? We saw that last week. Philo, whenever he talks about Jewish settlement abroad, he uses the Greek word apoikia, because colony is a positive phenomena in the eyes of the Greeks. That legitimizes living outside of your homeland. If you're there to set up a colony, to spread culture, that's okay. So she, this Jerusalem is the mother city, not of one country, but of most of the other, in virtue of the colonies set out at diverse times to the neighboring lands. And now comes a long description of where Jews live, and they live everywhere, of course. And if I skip down, till about, he in the end says, I'm about seven lines from the end, I say nothing of the countries beyond the Euphrates, meaning, whoa, beyond there, tons of Jews on the other side of the Euphrates. Why? Babylon, all the other satrapies where the land within their confines is fertile, have Jewish inhabitants. And now comes the punchline. Here's King, he would become King Agrippa the First, approaching the Roman Emperor, trying to dissuade him from setting up this abomination, as it were, so that if my own home city is granted a share of your goodwill, the benefit extends not to one city, but to myriads of the others situated in every region of the inhabited world, whether in Europe or in Asia or in Libya, in the mainlands, on the islands, whether it be seaboard or inland. What is this? This is the most obvious veiled threat you can imagine. In other words, it's couched in positive terms. If you are benevolent to my city, you are benevolent to Jews throughout the world. But of course, what is the hidden message? If you do this to Jerusalem, you're warned, you're going to have an international uprising on your hands. Now, of course, one can assume that Gaius knew what the intention was. But let me ask you, let's say the statue had been erected. Would it have caused an international rebellion of Jews throughout the diaspora? See, now that's the problem. We know that some years later, after the destruction of the Second Temple, there will be a Jewish uprising in much of the Roman diaspora, and maybe even beyond the Roman diaspora, in North Africa, in Egypt, in Cyprus, during the reign of the Emperor Trajan. The question is, was it caused by a particular event, or was there some sort of messianic zeal going on at the time? We don't know. But Philo assumes that Agrippa would have had sufficient, at least, knowledge that Jews might react abroad. Although we're going to, I can mention this already now. The Jews rose up in rebellion against the Romans in the year 66, which led to the destruction. How many Jews came from the diaspora to help out? Well, there was one cohort from the land of Adiabene, which is beyond Babylon, of converts. They're the ones who came. But the fact is that there is actually no support at all that we know about from Jews of the diaspora, even though the temple was the issue and was about to be destroyed. Some 60 years later, the Bar Kokhba uprising. A major uprising, which some people claim that numbers-wise exceeded the first uprising. How many Jews of the diaspora came to help out? Even though the Roman historian Cassius Dio says people from all over participated, the fact is we know nothing about any help that came from the diaspora. And so the question is, what is this based on? In other words, there's a sense of, yes, Jews are loyal to Jerusalem, but was that loyalty really tested? And again, none of this is relevant to today. Right? But you can all imagine, right, how it might be tested. But here, the silence, at least at certain stages of Second Temple history, is, I think, quite, if not probative, certainly is telling. We have to really focus on what was the nature of the relationship. And was it what we would call a national identity Is it a religious identity? Did people think along those categories of national versus, or not versus, but as distinct from religious identity? What was the nature of the diaspora's connection to Jerusalem? And then, of course, my next question will be further down today. Did it go in the other direction as well? When could Jews of the land of Israel actually help their brethren in diaspora? And in what way? And we'll see that there were one or two cases, not too many, but one or two cases. The obvious connection of Jews to Jerusalem, at least, to Israel, was through, I think, two issues, pilgrimage and financial support. These can't be denied. And so on second page, I don't know, beginning with source number 6, we read, first I chose to begin with pilgrimage and then to get to financial support, because financial support, again, will conjure up all sorts of imagery that might be familiar to you. Pilgrimage, Philo, in one of his books, describes the masses coming to Jerusalem. I could have quoted all sorts of sources. Josephus obviously refers to it a number of times. Philo says, countless multitudes from countless cities come, some over land, others over sea, from east, west, north, south, at every frieze. But he says something that we would not have thought of. When you read the biblical requirement for pilgrimage, what is the effect? What is stressed? You appear before God, Yira'eh kol zchurcha, right? And you offer up sacrifices. Is there a social interaction referred to in the Bible? Not really. The interaction is between people and God, either through sacrifice or what other behavior is there. Philo, and Josephus as well, I didn't bring the source, introduces something which actually might be mirrored in Christian source as well. They take the temple for their port as a general haven and safe refuge from the bustle and great turmoil of life. Friendships are formed between those who hitherto knew not each other. And this is something you never would have gotten using the Bible. And that is pilgrimage and the temple as a bonding process for the Jewish people. The Christian source, Acts, which is the next source here, will actually say it's almost miraculous, because think about this. People are coming from all these disparate countries. How do they talk to one another? And in what language did they speak? Right? Especially when you compare those people on this side of the Euphrates with those on the other side of the Euphrates. Those who knew Greek, those who didn't know Greek, or Latin, or what other language. Source number 6 ends by saying, and the sacrifices and libations are the occasion of reciprocity of feeling and constitute the surest pledge that all are of one mind. In other words, again, this is an element that we would not have thought of just reading the biblical account for pilgrimage, that this creates a certain cohesiveness within the community. In other words, people recognize that they're one community because they meet during a pilgrimage. In the book of Acts, we get another interesting piece of information. He describes there when the day of Pentecost was fully come, meaning when Sheva Shavuot were counted off, they were all with one heart in one place. And he, of course, tells us, the author, where they come from: Parthians, Medes, Elamites, meaning the east, dwellers in Mesopotamia, in Judea, Cappadocia. Right now we're in Turkey already, in Pontus, Asia, Phrygia, Pamphylia, and then Egypt, parts of Libya, Cyrene, blah, blah, blah. But then comes something interesting. And strangers of Rome, Jews and proselytes. That's interesting, and we're going to get back to those proselytes later, right? Jews and Cretes, Arabians. In other words, again, the source stresses people coming from all over, and again, creating some sort of, they were of one heart in one place. The book of Acts also refers, then there arose persons from the synagogue of the Libertines, meaning freed slaves, I'll talk about that in a second, and Cyrenians and Alexandrians and those of Cilicia and of Asia. And this is a certain event that takes place in the book of Acts, where they get into a fight with Stephen, but that doesn't interest me. Jerusalem had synagogues of Alexandrians, well, libertines, freed slaves, apparently made their way back to Jerusalem, Cyrenians, Alexandrians, those of Cilicia, Landsmannschaften. In other words, what you have in Jerusalem is sort of like a mini, right, a microscopic image of the Jewish people that, and by the way, we may have even found, not we, this is over 100 years ago, the cornerstone of one of these synagogues. In the southern part of Jerusalem, not far from Brechat Chizkiyahu, in that area, the pool, the Siloam pool, way back in the beginning of the 20th century, the Rothschilds asked an archaeologist to search for the burial plot of David or the kings of the Davidic family. They didn't find it, obviously. What they did find was a stone, a cornerstone of a synagogue built by a fellow called Theodotus, the son of Vetenos, who built the synagogue, among other things. He tells us why. I built it for people coming from abroad. And all the names there on that, his name, his father's name, his son's name, Simonides, these are all Greek Roman names. I built it for people coming from abroad, and I built a waterwork and a hostel and a place to hear the Torah and to understand it. In fact, what did he leave out? Prayer. And had you told Theodotus, what about prayer? What would his answer have been? You want to talk to God? You see that building up on the hill over there? That's where it's done. Buy an animal on the way. That's the way it's done, right? But it seems to me that we may have found one of these synagogues of one of these groups from outside of the country that set up shop here. But the point is that pilgrimage really was the great gathering point, and nobody denies this. So here is one element of the relationship. The other element is the financial support. And here we have all sorts of interesting sources. For instance, source number 8, again, Philo talking about those days of Gaius Caligula and the requirement placed upon Petronius, the Roman governor, to set up some sort of a statue in Jerusalem. And Petronius is afraid. Why? He bethought him the vast number of people comprised in the nation, which needed to contain it, not like every other, the circumference of a single country. You notice how Philo constantly repeats this. Allotted to itself alone, but one might say the whole habitable world. It spread all over. To draw all these myriads into war against him was surely very dangerous. He was frightened by forces beyond the Euphrates, Jews living in Iraq and beyond. And why is he so afraid? Because these people have one common connection. They're all connected to Jerusalem. If I tamper with Jerusalem, I'm in trouble. For every year, envoys were dispatched for the sacred purpose of conveying to the temple a great quantity of gold and silver, amassed from the first fruits. And these envoys travel over the pathless, trackless, endless routes. This is what happens when philosophers start writing history, right? The pathless, trackless, endless routes, which seem to them good high roads because they feel that they lead them to piety. This is Philo, who came probably for one pilgrimage in his lifetime and took a course in Hebrew 001, we think. We're not too sure how good his Hebrew was. But he recognizes that this was a major issue. Jews from all over sent money to Jerusalem. When did this begin? Yes, please. Okay, but there is absolutely no. If we look at the second book of Maccabees, we see that somebody in the diaspora wrote about the Hasmonean uprising, and then apparently the Jews of Jerusalem wrote letters to the diaspora saying, celebrate with us. However, there's no mention there of financial support. Oh, doesn't work. No, here's another example. The Hasmoneans rebel in Israel. Where's diaspora Judaism? Silent. After they're victorious, then somebody in North Africa, right, Jason of Cyrene, will write a history, right? Historians are great. They, you know, when they know the end of the story, then they sit down and write the history, right? But where's the participation? Where's the myriads coming to help the priests of Jerusalem against Christ? They're not there. So I think that really enforces that sense. Actually, we do not know about financial support of the temple until we get to the later Hasmonean period. There's no, in the Persian period, we're told under Nehemiah that people gave a third of a shekel to Jerusalem. But A, by the way, you notice the shirt of a third of a shekel ultimately becomes a half a shekel, and it's called inflation, right? But that's from Jews living in Israel. We know nothing about a systematic support system for the temple from the diaspora until we get to the late, and it's interesting that the earliest sources we have are all non-Jewish, right? Philo, well, or non-rabbinic at least, Josephus, the earliest, by far the earliest source, and we're going to read him in a few minutes, is Cicero, who describes in detail the sending of funds to Jerusalem. But Philo just tells us masses, right? We know of the amount of money that's conveyed, but Philo's first century common era. Josephus also makes this point, number 9. But no one need wonder that there was so much wealth in our temple for all the Jews throughout the habitable world. He adds something. And those who worship God, even from Asia and Europe, Asia meaning Asia Minor, meaning Turkey, had been contributing to it for a very long time. This is interesting. Josephus tells us that not only did Jews send money, but also those who worship God. I'm sure some of you may be familiar, but in antiquity, there was this phenomena of the God-fearers, those people who may not have converted to Judaism per se, but through a process of adhesion, maybe they embraced monotheism, maybe some other elements of Judaism, and they are referred to as the phobumenoi, the God-fearers, or in Latin, the metuentes. Some of them ultimately would become Jews, others would find their way into the Christian world, right? But what Josephus tells us is that at one stage, right, they also send money to the temple, hence the wealth of funds in our temple. But the most important source is that's source number 10, which later on I'll go on to source number 16. This is a major event. And it takes place a few years after the Hasmonean kingdom was conquered by the Romans. The Romans conquered Jerusalem, Pompeii, in 63 BCE. Just two or three years after that, the Roman governor of Asia Minor, Flaccus was his name, tried to prevent Jews from sending money from Turkey, from Asia Minor, to Jerusalem. He confiscated the funds. Flaccus was taken to trial at Rome. Now, it wasn't just Jews that demanded his trial. Apparently, he had been taking money from all sorts of other groups from the eastern parts of the empire, as I said, Turkey or Asia Minor, and a number of groups demanded that Flaccus be brought to trial before some sort of tribunal in Rome. But Jews were part of this. Who was appointed to be his defense attorney? The greatest of all Roman orators, Cicero. Actually, you should know, the Roman system was that you very often had two attorneys working for you, right? I have to be very careful what I talk about today with attorneys. I know this is there might be some of them among us. I have to be careful, right? I had a whole list of ideas that I wanted to throw out. You know, I was in shock. Who ever heard of, you know, corrupt lawyers? I mean, my gosh. This is I'm still in shock. Okay. Cicero, the system was that you had two attorneys working for you. One of them was the fellow who spent time with the law books, looking up all the precedents and working out the case detail by detail. And then there's the other attorney. He's the great orator. I could name you names from very famous trials of the last 20 or 30 years, right? The F. Lee Baileys or the others. And that was Cicero, right? He was there to put on a presentation, to arouse anti-Eastern feelings among the judges, to look at these Easterners as barbarians, and to support, right, the pride of the Roman people. And he does this, Cicero. We have his speech, Pro Flacco, in our hands. And he describes, I, of course, just quoted the Jewish aspect. When every year it was customary to send gold to Jerusalem on the order of the Jews from Italy and from all our provinces, Flaccus forbade by an edict exportation from Asia, meaning from Turkey. Who is there, gentlemen, who could not honestly praise this action? And you know, Cicero elsewhere, I skipped over this, says just a few years ago these Jews were fighting against the Roman army in Jerusalem. But he goes on, who could not honestly praise this action, meaning of confiscating the money? The Senate, often earlier and also in my consulship, forbade its exportation from Asia. Where then is there ground for an accusation against Flaccus? But now comes something more interesting. He actually tells us how much money was gathered in each city of Asia Minor. How did he know? How could he know how much? Well, let's look at this first. At Apamea, a little less than 100 pounds of gold was openly seized and weighed before the seat of the praetor in the forum through the agency of, right, a Roman knight, an upright and honorable man. What is the point? All of these funds that were confiscated by Flaccus were brought to Rome. And so Cicero can say, this amount was taken from this city, this amount from that city. 100 pounds of gold. Somebody wrote an article about this speech, a well-known article, Yohanan Levi, around the year 1940, and he imagined that the 100 pounds of gold were worth about $22,500 at the time in 1940. So what would it be worth today? You can figure out, right? An enormous amount of money. And he goes on from city to city. At Apamea, a little less than 100. At Laodicea, a little more than 20 pounds. At Adramyttium, 100 pounds. At Pergamum, a small amount. The accounting for the gold is correct. The gold is in the treasury, meaning we know these are the amounts. These are enormous amounts. And what he's saying is, this is crazy to have all this money leave a Roman province and move to Jerusalem. It's ridiculous. And so Flaccus did the only normal thing. He confiscated the funds. And that's why he's being brought for trial. The opening of Cicero's speech is the one that everybody likes to point to. Look at source, I'm skipping for a moment, to source number 16. And here we come across the question of, okay, so there are Jews living all over the Roman world. Are they a lobby? Can we put our hands on APAC of the Roman period? Look at what Cicero has to say. This is the beginning of that same speech that I read for you. There follows the odium that is attached to the Jewish gold. In other words, up to now, he had spoken about all these other cities that claimed that Flaccus had stolen money from them. Now comes the Jewish gold. And then he kind of, sort of digresses for a minute. This is no doubt the reason, in other words, because Jews are involved, this is no doubt the reason why this case is being tried not far from the Aurelian Steps. By the way, does anybody know where the Aurelian Steps are? Right near the Forum Romanum. You have these steps, and there's a statue there of a horse and some sort of Roman emperor or general, right? Huh? Right, even though the Aurelian Steps were named that before Marcus Aurelius, right? Nevertheless, I know why the trial is taking place here, Cicero says. And he's talking now to the prosecutor, the Roman prosecutor, Lollius. You procured this place and that crowd for this trial. You know what a big crowd it is.
how they stick together,
right?
How influential they are in informal assemblies. In other words, Cicero is playing now on the basis, right, feelings, right? The Jewish lobby is out there, right? They come to meetings. They make a to-do. They stick together, right? And they look out. We'll see this in Tacitus in a few minutes. They look out for their own, right? All of the words that we recognize today as being, right, classic anti-Semitism, the basis for these statements already appear in classical literature, right? So what does he say? Because they're so influential, so I will speak in a low voice so that only the jurors may hear. I don't want these other people to hear what I have to say, so I'm going to lower my voice, right? For those are not wanting who would incite them against me, and now comes an interesting line, against every respectable man. In other words, they are the riffraff, right? But we're going to see in a few minutes that this is not the only case where the Jewish riffraff tries to influence Roman policy. They're there, and they will do this when they think it's required. But he's drawing this, right, comparison between respectable Romans and the others. I shall not help them to do this more easily. Right? Yes, please. Okay, yes. It wasn't the Senate, but it was sort of an informal, a semi-formal trial, but yes, with jurors, right? And by the way, Flaccus wins in the end, right? Or we lost, as the case may be, right? But again, this is Cicero, and you know, you're up against, right, the most prominent legal defense you could imagine, right? And he wins. But, of course, what is important is this is the first actual reference that we have to Jews sending money to Jerusalem. And it's right after the fall of the Hasmonean kingdom, although they'll continue there as semi-rulers for a few more decades. But think about this for a minute. We have Jews in Rome fighting for the right of Jews in Asia Minor to send money to the Jews of Jerusalem. So you do have this connection here of Jews outside of the land of Israel involved, actively involved in Jewish affairs outside of the country, right? Outside of their own country. So here at least we have one example where there is some sort of involvement. But again, I stress, you could say it's for religious reasons. It's money being sent to the temple. In other words, would they have gotten involved in what is a much more political activity? We'll see this in a few minutes. Now, Rome, if you look at source number 11, the Romans actually gave the Jews permission to send. In other words, the official line in Rome would become, and certainly from Augustus on, and actually probably from Julius Caesar as well, the official line was Jews can send money to Jerusalem. And we have a number of edicts, right, of legal imperial declarations, and here we have one of them in source number 11. Gaius Norbanus Flaccus, proconsul to the magistrates of the Ephesians, greeting. Caesar has written me that the Jews, wherever they may be, regularly, according to their old peculiar tradition, make a rule of meeting together and subscribing money which they sent to Jerusalem. He, meaning Caesar, does not wish them to be hindered from doing this. I therefore write to you that this is what he orders to be done. This is quoted by Philo, a very similar edict by Josephus, and there's tons of literature on this. Are these authentic decrees or not? Or are they, in fact, inventions, right, meaning something that Philo or Josephus would want to present to his non-Jewish audience. But as I said, this idea of Romans, like Cicero, opposed to Jewish behavior on behalf of other Jews, this takes roots in Rome.
And the most blatant example is a long, long chapter on the Jews written by the Roman historian of the first century, Tacitus, in his History, Book 5. We could have spent all evening just reading that text. He goes on at length how the Jews were formed as a nation. He gives us six different stories, one of them being the Exodus story. But then he goes on with this statement. And this is critical, and you'll see why in a second. The other customs of the Jews are base and abominable, and owe their persistence to their depravity. For the worst rascals among other peoples, renouncing their ancestral religions, so here you already have an allusion to these people who are making their way into Jewish ranks, right? They are the God-fearers or something like that. What do they do? What's the first thing that comes to mind in Tacitus? Once you join up with that crowd, always kept sending tribute and contributing to Jerusalem. Ah, but now comes the next line. Thereby increasing the wealth of the Jews. So if you thought that these lines are, right, begin with the Middle Ages, right, and then into modernity, the Jews and the wealth that they, right, goes back to the first century. Not only that, look at the next line. Again, the Jews are extremely loyal toward one another and always ready to show compassion, but toward every other people they feel only hate and enmity. Now, this is interesting because, first of all the, you know, many of us believe that this type of ancient anti-Semitism grows out of the Christian church for all sorts of reasons. But here you have pagan authors, right, who are very, very explicit in talking about Jewish wealth. Jews care only for themselves, not for others. Now, there's another statement that Tacitus makes. I skipped over it, where he says very simply, everything that is the Jews revere, everything that is abominable to us, and vice versa. Everything that we revere, they, meaning, or everything that the Romans revere, the Jews consider an abomination. You should know why this is so critical for subsequent Jewish history. Now I'm talking about medieval and modern. Because beginning with the Renaissance, when Latin literature found its way into the curriculum, into school curriculums throughout much of Europe, one of the books that was read in the Middle Ages and down into early modernity was Tacitus and his history. So every school or every student in a serious school environment would have read a text like this. And so it had a tremendous effect, right, on youngsters growing up at a certain time throughout Europe. But the point is that here we have constant allusions to the fact that Jews send money to Jerusalem. This is the ultimate support system. And later on, we read about this in rabbinic literature as well. And I gave you one source here, source number 13, that describes how these monies were distributed or dealt with when they came to Jerusalem. You remember, if you remember the Mishnah, the new funds, the announcement went out in the month of Adar that new shkalim have to be sent to the temple, and the next month would be considered the first month of the new year, and you would use the new funds to buy sacrifices for the coming year. The Tosefta, which is an early rabbinic text, describes how the official in the temple removed funds from the first contribution and proclaimed, "Behold, this is from Eretz Yisrael for all of Israel." In other words, the earliest money came, of course, from the closest territory of the land of Israel. It arrived in Jerusalem. You would take out a portion of that money to be used in the temple, and then you would cover the rest with leather spreads. Why? Because the people of Syria come and contribute additionally. In other words, the point is going to be, Israeli money is put here, all the, right, this represents what was sent from the Jews of Israel. Let's take out a portion. So the Jews of Israel are covered. Now we cover up this fund so that the new money coming, let's say, from Syria and adjacent lands, right, would also be represented in sacrificial worship and other expenses. So we take out a second portion of the money in, I would say, representing funds sent from Syria. And you would recite, behold, this is from Ammon and Moab and from cities surrounding Eretz Israel. Then you would cover up that money because now new funds would be coming in from Babylonia and add to it. So the idea being, and this of course is critical, the shkalim represent money from all of Jewry. And a point was made that portions of these funds from every land be used for sacrificial worship. We can go, my late teacher, Professor Shmuel Safai, wrote about this at length. As a result of this, of course, these funds were used not only for sacrificial worship, but for the maintenance of the city of Jerusalem, the pavement of streets, the strengthening of walls. Now, of course, you realize, I always imagine pilgrims coming. And, you know, knowing modern Jewish mentality, I always imagine pilgrims of the Second Temple period arriving in Israel and immediately declaring, I want to see what they've been doing with my money, right? Not realizing that your shekel may have gone to the sewage system of Jerusalem last year, right? But there is this idea that Jerusalem belongs to the nation because it's supported by the nation, and a whole series of laws resulted that preclude any private ownership. For instance, you're not allowed to ask for rent in the city of Jerusalem because you don't really own the house in which you live or the land on which your house is situated. You can't ask for rent, and you have to imagine what places like, you know, the King David Hotel would do today, right? If you told them, as a result, what they would do is they would give homeowners some of the residue of temple worship as an inducement, open up your house and let these pilgrims live there, right? So they would give them leather from the animals, right? Leather that remained after animals were slaughtered, etc. The idea being, to include the Jews of the diaspora as citizens of the city of Jerusalem. Now, I want to depart and ask a simple question. So Jews send money to Jerusalem for the upkeep of the temple, for the upkeep of the city of Jerusalem. What happens after the destruction? Do they continue to send money? To whom do they send money? And now our problem is, obviously they can't send money to the temple. It doesn't exist anymore. City of Jerusalem, yes, there are a few Jews that live there, but it's a tiny, it's a smattering of Jews. The city has really lost its role, as it were, in Jewish life, active life. We read sources that money still came to Israel, but for more specific purposes. Now, here we have a problem. Some of our sources, or most of the sources, are rabbinic sources. The Talmud, the Midrash. Rabbinic sources will say, yes, they continued to send money to us. And so now, right, these shipments of funds, it was assumed by the rabbis, went to them. And we hear about this in a number of places. I love source number 14, and you'll see why. Because I had actually suggested that this be used in some sort of a handbook for shlichim from the Jewish agency who go abroad. You'll see why in a second. A man's gift maketh... So this, as I say, is a digression. We're going next week. That's when we get into the real nitty-gritty of what happens to the centrality of the land when there's no longer a temple and no longer Jerusalem. What is the ongoing commitment to the land? Was there an ongoing commitment? And this becomes a very crucial issue and a debated issue at the time. But here we have this nice story. A man's gift maketh for him and brings him before great men. Once Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Joshua and Rabbi Akiva, meaning a generation somewhere between the destruction of the Second Temple and the Bar Kokhba War, went to the harbor area of Antioch in Syria to make a collection for support of the sages. In other words, see, I always imagine, right, these are shlichim going abroad to make an appeal for yeshivot in Eretz Yisrael. And I say this with a lot of nostalgia, because that's where I learned public speaking as a child in Brooklyn. Growing up, my father was a good speaker. And I would be 5 years old, 4 years old, 6 years old. And whenever a holiday came about, he was asked to make an appeal for some, you know, yeshiva or some institution. And he would schlep me along to that. And I would see how this was done. And apparently, this is what's going on. But of course, you know, this is Rabbi Akiva. Everybody showed up to hear the speech or whatever it was. And they come to make a collection. There was a man there by the name of Ava Yudan, who used to provide maintenance liberally. Now, it's interesting. For the needy doesn't actually appear in all the sources. And I think somebody was uncomfortable, you know, and may have added, right, those words. He subsequently, meaning Ava Yudan, this benefactor, became impoverished. And when he saw our rabbis, because they came every year, his face turned the color of saffron, right? Nitkar kemupanav. When he came to his wife, she said to him, "Why is your face sickly?" Said he to her, "My rabbis are here. I do not know what to do." His wife, who was saintlier than he, and I like this phrase, it is right out of Agnon, right? You know, ishto shahaita tzadeket mimenu, right? Said, "We have nothing left except yon field. Go sell half. We have one field left, right? Go sell half of it. Give them the proceeds." He listened to his wife. He did it. And they prayed for him, the rabbis, saying, "May the all-present make good your deficiency." After some days, he went to plow the half field he retained. And as he was plowing, his cow fell and its leg was broken. And I imagine him saying, "You know, I had to listen to my wife for this," right? You know, the one thing he had was this one cow, and now it's a cow without a leg, right? But when he went down to lift it up, the Holy One, blessed be He, gave light to his eyes. He found a treasure there underneath the ground. And he said, "My cow's leg was broken, but it turned out to be for my benefit." Now the storyteller says, when our rabbis came there again, they inquired about him, saying, "How is Abba Yudan doing?" And they were told, "Ha-ha, he's Abba Yudan, the possessor of servants, Abba Yudan of goats, Abba Yudan of camels, Abba Yudan of oxen. Who can catch a glimpse of Abba Yudan?" In other words, the rabbis come to Antioch, and the people there say, "You want to talk to Abba Yudan? Make an appointment with his secretary." Right? He's not available. But of course, in the end, when he, Abba Yudan, heard of the rabbi's presence, he went out, where are we, to meet them. They said, "How is Abba Yudan doing?" He replied, "Your prayer has produced fruit, and fruit of fruit, perot to ferre perot." But now comes the best line in this story. And this is what I think is what every shaliach should learn. They said to him, "As you live, even though others gave more than you," I love that line, right? This is peer pressure now, right? You know, you should know you're not giving the most. There are other people. "Even though others gave more than you, we wrote you down at the head of the book." In other words, they have a Sefer HaZahav, right? And if you give enough money, you're written down in the book. Then they took him and gave him a seat with themselves. In other words, this is probably taking place in some synagogue, and they told the benefactor, "Now you can come and sit near us." They know all the tricks of the trade, right? They begin by saying, "You haven't been giving enough, others are giving more." He gives them something. "Ooh, we are going to inscribe you in the book," and right, and this ostentatious, right, honor. And they apply to him the verse, "A man's gift maketh room for him and brings him before great men." Right. What is interesting is we have other stories. We have another rabbi in the 3rd century, Rabbi Chia Bar Abba,
who goes abroad to gather money for almanot v'yitomim, for widows and for orphans. He gathers the money, and instead of giving it to the women and the orphans, he gives it to the rabbis. In other words, again, rabbinic literature here seems to be somewhat insular, saying, this is an internal thing, and people who go abroad for money. Now, we don't have any Greek sources about this or Roman sources, but we do know that money continued to be gathered from abroad and sent to Israel, but by whom? By the Jewish patriarch, the Nasi. And this goes on until around the year 400. In other words, for the coming few hundred years, there still is money moving from the diaspora to the land of Israel. How do we know this? Because the Roman law books, and in particular, I brought one of the laws here, number 15, the Theodosian Code, and this is a law from the year April 399, where the Roman, whoever's producing this law, decrees it is no longer legal for Jews to send money to the Nasi, to the patriarch in the land of Israel. Probably these laws were instigated by pressure from the church, because now we are already in the Byzantine period, and we know this as a fact, that the patriarch was a major target of the church simply because he claimed Davidic descendant, that he's a descendant of the house of David, but of course the Davidic lineage has already fulfilled itself with Jesus, and so any pretender to Davidic lineage would be perceived as a threat, Roy, or as some sort of opposition. It is a matter of shameful superstition that the archai synagogues, meaning the head of either the synagogue or the communities, the presbyters, the elders of the Jews, those they call apostles. This is a very interesting phenomenon. A number of people, including myself, have written about this. You can read about it in the book that costs $238, right? We referred to that last week, right? Somebody else actually asked me, you know, how much does it really cost? And I gave the standard answer. If you have to ask how much it costs, you can't afford it, right? But in that book, I do deal with the issue of the apostles. Apparently, Jews have a system of messengers being sent out by the patriarch, and this is alluded to in the Talmud Yerushalmi in a number of places. One of them was this fellow Chiya Bar Abba that I mentioned before. And they would gather money and bring it back to the land of Israel and give it to the patriarch. And so those who were sent by the patriarch on a certain date, maybe the month of Adar, we don't know, to demand gold and silver, exact and receive a sum from each synagogue and deliver it to him. Therefore, everything that we are confident has been collected when the period of time is considered shall now be faithfully transferred to our treasury. And we decree that henceforth nothing shall be sent to the aforesaid. Let the populace of the Jews know, therefore, we have removed this depredatory tax. If, however, people shall send, or people shall be sent to perform this tax of exaction by that despoiler of the Jews, meaning the Nasi, these people shall be handed over to the governors in order that they shall be sentenced as violators of our laws. Basically, by the beginning of the 5th century, we cease to hear about money being sent to the land of Israel from the diaspora. So this law is one of the major stages towards the cessation of a phenomenon that had existed at least from the 1st century BC, maybe from the 2nd century BCE as well, probably not much earlier. But there were other links. It's not just money, financial support, pilgrimage, and so on. And this is where I think things have to take a more... By the way, I can't forget this. I spoke about... Here. Support being sent for the rabbis. The Palestinian Talmud, Yerushalmi, in Tractate Pesachim, this is not on your source sheet. I forgot
to include it, and I really should have. We are told the following. There's a sage living in Rome. His name is Todas Ishromi. And he told the Jews of Rome that on Passover, they can cook their meal, as it were, in a way that apparently was very reminiscent or too close to the way the Passover sacrifice was offered up in the temple. And that's really improper in rabbinic eyes. You don't do things that appear to be usurping the role of the temple by doing it outside of the temple. And so they would cook their meat in a particular way. The rabbis of the land of Israel were very upset by this behavior of this Roman sage. And so they write him as follows. Ilulei she'ata todis, were it not you, todus, hayinu menadim otcha. We would, lenadot, we would excommunicate you. You really deserve excommunication, but your todus, we're not going to do it. Whereupon the Talmud says, what does it mean? Mahu todus, what's so special about todus? Why does he warrant an exemption? Right? And the answer is, Amar Rabbi Chanani, Dehava meshalach parnasaton de rabbanin. Because he used to send parnasa to the rabbis. And you would have expected this to have been taken out. I mean, in other words, it looks a little, I don't know, maybe improper, uncomfortable. But no, because the rabbis are living within this context that we are now the nucleus of the Jewish people, and so we have to be supported at all costs, and I understand it. But this is really an admission, right, that the support probably was limited to certain elements within the Jewish population, and the Nasi, for all we know, might have been doing the same thing, sending out these messengers, these apostoloi, to gather funds. But there are other connections in the Second Temple period that I refer to as political influence and that I refer to as the Jewish lobby. Well, we read number 16, Cicero, but let me give you another example, number 17. And the story takes us to around the year 103 or 102 before the Common Era. The very beginning of the rule of the last powerful Jewish king, Hasmonean king, Alexander Janneus. Alexander Yanai began his rule in a very, very difficult situation. The country was invaded by a pretender to the Egyptian throne. His name was Ptolemy Lathyros, who begins capturing major parts of the Hasmonean kingdom, and he's about to capture the entire kingdom when his mother, the queen of Egypt, Cleopatra, invades the country and kicks her own son Ptolemy, out of Israel. In other words, she, Cleopatra, queen of Egypt, saves the Hasmonean dynasty or monarchy and kingdom. Whereupon, her generals tell her, you know, you really saved the Hasmonean kingdom. Why give it up now? Why not just take it over for yourself? As an extension of Egypt. It's right near us. He can't keep his own kingdom. He wasn't successful. You have been. Now, and this is source number 17. Now there were some of Cleopatra's friends who persuaded her to seize Alexander Janneus and to overrun and take possession of the country, and not to sit still and see such a multitude of brave Jews subject to one man, meaning Janneus. And then something happens. One of Cleopatra's commanders in the Egyptian army tells her, you can't do this. You can't capture the Hasmonean kingdom. Now, of course, this surprises us. Why such benevolence? Why such a wonderful pro-Jewish stance? Maybe it has something to do with the fact that the name of the commander in Cleopatra's army was Hanania. Maybe. Not only is his name Hanania, he is a descendant of Onias, the high priest of Jerusalem, prior to the Hasmonean uprising. He's from a very prominent Jerusalem family, which, you know, I could stop here. So here you have a Jew, prominent Jerusalemite family, makes his way to Egypt, and you know that they actually, his family set up a temple there, the Temple of Onias, which was sort of almost competition of sorts to Jerusalem, right? But it tells you something about the openness of the Hellenistic world. If you spoke Greek and you thought in Greek, as it were, if you behaved properly, you could reach almost the highest levels of the Hellenistic hierarchy. You would never be king or queen because that was you had to be a good Macedonian or descendant of the Macedonians. But this is an interesting development, and I'm reading this now. But Hananiah's counsel was contrary to theirs. But look at what his reasoning, or rather what his argument is. As he said, she would do an injustice by depriving an ally, Janaeus was her ally, of the authority that belonged to him. And now comes the punchline. And this, a man that is related to us. For I would not have the ignorant of this, that whatever injustice you do to him will make all us, meaning Jews, that are Jews, your enemy. This has nothing to do with the temple anymore. In other words, here you have a prominent Jew in Egypt turning to the queen and saying, we are opposed to this policy of capturing Israel. And if you do proceed, we Jews here will oppose you. And apparently this is a potent group. So here we already have something interesting where diaspora Jews can offer the Jews of the land of Israel not just financial support and not just pilgrimage, but a major a component of their own well-being. This is only one example of this type of link. We have another, I brought another two examples. One of them is source number 18. Which tells us how Julius Caesar, who had defeated Pompey, the conqueror of Jerusalem, but Julius Caesar defeated him, and then invades Egypt, and he wants basically to fulfill the dream of Rome at the time, and that is conquering all of the Middle East. When Caesar, after his victory over Pompey, and the latter's death, Pompey, was fighting in Egypt, Antipater, the governor of the Jews, under orders from Hyrcanus II, the Hasmonean high priest, provided himself useful to Caesar in many ways. And here I made a long story short, and this is me talking here now. Josephus proceeds to describe how Antipater, who is an aide to the Jewish high priest, with 3,000 heavily armed Jewish soldiers, intervenes to support the components of Caesar's army. In other words, a Jewish army from Israel is aiding Julius Caesar to conquer Egypt. But the Jews from the district of Onias, the Egyptian Jews at first, opposed Caesar. Antipater, however, persuaded them to side with his party on the ground of their common nationality. This is interesting. In other words, Jews of Israel turn to Jews in Egypt and say, we want you to support Julius Caesar. We're on his side. And here's a letter from the Jerusalem high priest to that effect. And Josephus tells us that's what happens. By the way, Julius Caesar is a good guy. And you know that when he was killed, and one of the Roman historians describes how people come gathering in Rome to weep over Julius Caesar's death, the Roman historian says, and more than any other, the Jews gathered and wept over his death. They considered him a benefactor. Jews considered Julius Caesar to be a benefactor. And I am convinced, as a high school student here in Israel, that that's why, of all of Shakespeare that we had to study for Bagrut, it was Julius Caesar, right? That we study. Somebody up there in Misrad HaChinuch knew Second Temple history, right? And decreed. Anyway, here we have another example, though, again, of links between Jews of diaspora and the Jews of Israel and this behavior, right, or this, I would say, common endeavor to achieve something. Source number 19 is yet another example. And here it's really of a Jewish lobby of sorts. Herod, King, famous or infamous King Herod, dies in the year 4 BC. And he is succeeded by his son Archelaus, who will rule for 10 years and then he'll be banished. But there was opposition to this succession by Archelaus. And Archelaus, I'm reading now from source 19, the son of Herod had a new source of trouble at Rome with the following. An embassy of Jews had come to Rome from Judea that they might petition for the liberty of living by their own laws. In other words, a delegation of Jews leaves Israel for Rome, asking for the end of Herodian rule in Judea. Yes. Ooh. I have another 300 years to go here. Okay. So there's a delegation that leaves Jerusalem. Now, the number of ambassadors that were sent by the authority was 50, to which were joined over 8,000 Jews that were already in Rome, accusing Herod of such and such. In other words, you have a demonstration of Jews, Roman Jews, in the streets of Rome, on behalf of Jews in Israel, to do away with the Herodian kingdom. So again, there's a political influence going on in both directions here. Because I was told that we have to finish within the next few minutes. I just would have you look at section number E. Section number E projects already the rabbinic understanding of links between Israel and the diaspora. For the rabbis, originally, the center is Israel, the diaspora adheres to our teaching. Okay? So for instance, the Mishnah describes that the calendar would be regulated by sages in the land of Israel, and source number 21 describes they would then inform the diaspora by lighting flares on mountaintops, right, from the Mount of Olives and all the way into Babylonia, informing them about Rosh Chodesh. Source number 22 describes Rabban Gamliel or Shimon Gamliel, there are different versions here, standing on or sitting on the steps leading up to the temple. You know where that is. That's the steps of Huldah, the southern area of the Temple Mount, and I highly recommend those who haven't seen those steps. They're very impressive, right? And they sit and are writing, or the rabbi, Rabban Gamliel, is dictating a letter to the Jews of the diaspora, telling them it is, yes, the month that would normally be spring is about to begin, but the doves are young and there's still snow on the ground, etc., etc., and so we are adding another month to this year, proclaiming leap year. So the rabbis project this land of Israel, and probably with good reason, as being the center of halachic, right, instruction. Not only that, you have a source, number 23, that describes, we have just enough time, when the people of Alexandria would betroth women, another man would come and seize her from the marketplace. In other words, a woman, they distinguished between Erusim and Nisuim, right? You would be betrothed, and then time would pass before the ultimate marriage was consummated, as it were. And the woman in between is sort of in an intermediate stage. She's not quite a wife yet. And what happens if somebody kidnaps her and has a child by her? Is that child considered to be born out of wedlock? Because wedlock hasn't occurred yet. If you're born out of wedlock, you're a bastard, as it were. And so somebody would come and seize her from the marketplace. The case became before the sages, who wished to declare her children bastards. Hillel the elder said to them, bring me your mother's marriage contract, the ketubah. They produced it, and in it was written, when you enter my house, you shall become my wife. In other words, the marriage isn't complete until the woman actually enters the husband's house, and so anything that happened before then does not render offspring bastards. Why don't I bring this source? Women are in Alexandria. Something's happening in Alexandria. Whom do they write to for a solution? Hillel, who by this time has moved from Babylonia to the land of Israel. In other words, the underlying assumption is, if you need guidance, right, you go to the land of Israel for guidance. This is going to change. This perception that Torah comes from Eretz Yisrael, and we all have to look in that direction, as you head into the post-temple period, and more so into the Talmudic period, meaning 3rd, 4th, and 5th century, you'll find, and this is fascinating, that whereas the rabbis of the land of Israel would continue to claim Torah comes out of Zion, and we are the center of halachic decision-making, slowly you will begin to hear another approach. Let me just read this last source, number 24. And look at what comes out of this. In ancient times, when the Torah was forgotten from Israel, Ezra came up from Babylon and established it. It was again forgotten, and Hillel the Babylonian came up and established it. Yet again it was forgotten, and Rabbi Chiya and his sons in the 3rd century came up and established it. What is the assumption of this source? The Israelis can't get their act together. And they need constant what? A constant influx of Jews from the diaspora to set them straight. And suddenly you're going to encounter two approaches within rabbinic literature, quote, the Israeli approach and the diaspora approach. In my lecture 2 weeks from yesterday, right, we're going to see that ultimately the Babylonians are going to refer to themselves as Zion. Why? Because Zion no longer means real estate, a place. Zion stands for the yeshiva shesham mitzuyanim b'halacha. They excel, right, in halacha. And this is where the relationship between center and diaspora really takes on a whole new image. But this source here is already sort of, the beginning is sort of hinting at what's going to take place. We in the diaspora maintain Torah. And the question is, and this is the teaser for the next 2 weeks, right? Does this tell me, does this really suggest a major change in Jewish self-identity? If until now you were a nation that has all the attributes of a nation, which is land, capital city, maybe even an army, maybe a monarchy, are you slowly, or not, evolving it to something that others would call a, quote, religio, a religion? In which case, a religion? In which case the center is where the outstanding spokesman of that religion reside. If it's the land of Israel, then it's Israel. If it should happen to be Babylonia, then it will be Babylonia. And we're going to find that this becomes the major debate, or one of the major debates within the rabbinic world, and maybe within the larger Jewish world, self-identity. How to understand ourselves, to what extent the nation is still the focal point, to what extent are we becoming now a spiritualized entity, and spirit doesn't have a geographical focal point. This is already, of course, one of knowledge. And so this is why I am convinced that a study of the Israel-diaspora relationship is not just an interesting phenomenon per se, but it goes to the heart of Jewish self-identity, right? And we'll have to grapple with this issue in the next 2 weeks. I have to apologize for stealing time. I didn't realize that time went this fast. What? No. I'll end off with a famous story of a speaker like myself going on and on, right? And somebody in the audience screams out and says, you know, give him a watch, right? So he could see what time it is. And then somebody else screams out and says, give him a calendar, right? Okay.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.